Today's show is sponsored by Miracle Made. And oh my God, you guys, you know that I love a luxurious set of sheets. And I now have such a set of sheets because of a Miracle Made. They are bedding that has been inspired by NASA. They've got silver-infused fabrics that actually make temperature regulating a thing. So you're not like getting too hot or too cold or whatever, you know, the whole thing that happens with your body's temperature losing its mind. Miracle Made helps with that. One of the little things that my husband particularly loves about Miracle Made is that it like doesn't have as much bacteria as regular sheets because of it's infused with this silver that prevents up to 99.7% of bacterial growth. So it leaves the sheets cleaner for longer. And then the thing for my husband is that it doesn't give him acne, which is like an issue for some people. But more than all of that, it's just luxuriously comfortable and delightful. And it has that cooling feeling while also being cozy. Very hard to achieve those two things at the same time. I mean, Miracle Made, come on, well done. So here's what I think you should do. I think you should go to trymiracle.com/fakethenation and buy some sheets today. And if you order today, you can save 40% off. Use the promo code FAKETHENATION at the checkout and you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. So there's just a lot of savings here, folks. Order today, you'll get 40% off. Use the promo code FAKETHENATION. Go to trymiracle.com/FAKETHENATION. And Miracle's so confident in their product, it's backed with a 30-day money-back guarantee. So if you're not 100% satisfied, which I don't see happening, you'll get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiracle.com/fakethenation and use the code FAKETHENATION to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/fakethenation to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode.
Fake the Nation, episode 189.
Hello, hello, this is Fake the Nation, where we talk about news, we talk about politics, and where we search for fashionable alternatives to the medical face mask. Who's with me? I'm your host, Nikine Farsad, and I am the only one, am I the only one fielding panicked calls from their mother about coronavirus? Because I get one of those calls maybe twice a day.
Twice a day?
Well, there was two on one day. Wow. I don't mean to exaggerate her panic.
No, but much like coronavirus, the rate is accelerating.
The rate is accelerating. There it is. So today we're actually going to talk about that virus. We're also going to talk about the Democratic primary campaign for a change. We'll just mention it on this show. It started 25 short years ago. And by the time it's done, I will be filling out Medicare forms. So you know what we're also going to talk about? Corporations. What role do they have in climate change? And finally, darkness. Is it ever actually dark enough? I know, that's a weird one, but we're going to fucking talk about darkness. I know, guys, but I think it's going to be interesting. You know what's really interesting, though, is today's panel. Oh, my God, you guys. Joining me both, again, they're veterans of the show. This gentleman, he hails from Los Angeles, and he's normally not in town, but he's in town this week. We're so lucky to have him. You've heard him on Los Angeles editions of Fake the Nation, but he is the host of the Cracked podcast, and he's had me on the Cracked podcast. And Cracked podcast is so fun and smart.
Oh, thank you.
So smart.
Oh.
And he is so smart, and he's so great and so delightful. You guys, it's Alex Schmidt. Hey, Alex.
Nikine, that's the nicest intro I've gotten in centuries, I think, ever. That was
so
great.
Thank you. I practiced that in front of the mirror this morning, so I don't know why I had to involve the mirror, because this is not a visual format.
They can hear it, though. They can hear the dedication.
Okay. Also joining us on the panel today, you've heard him on the show before. He's officially veteran status. He's also even guest hosted when I've not been in this room. He's taken the helms of Fake the Nation. That's how good he is. We trust him with that. We would trust you too, Alex. Don't worry.
Oh, that's very sweet.
It's just like you don't live in town, so it's just not as simple. Okay,
no, he's the guy, though.
I didn't mean to turn his compliment into an offensive
you. You just can't help but compliment Alex.
I know.
It's amazing.
Like, I I want your intro to be a compliment of Alex, yes, is what I'm saying. Yeah. But you guys, you've heard his amazing work on the 538 podcast. You've heard his amazing work at the 30 for 30 series. I mean, should I mention he was a WNYC?
You can just say my name.
Under the guidance of Brian Lehrer, the one and only. You guys, he's so fantastic. It's Jody Evergan.
Hi. Whoa, what was that?
Hi. And he's 13 years old, and he's experiencing some changes.
Yeah. It is an honor to be here. And moreover, I mean, it's great to be here with you, but to be next to Alex.
I mean.
Who, I don't know if there's any other things you want to say.
He's delightful. He's great. The Cracked podcast is fantastic. Yeah.
I feel like what you're doing.
Point something else out about Alex. It's very cold here today in New York. He showed up wearing basically a sweatshirt, no coat. That's what an amazing person this is. He doesn't even feel cold, Jody. He literally doesn't feel it.
I was surprised when the outline came in and it just said Alex's greatness up top and like a giant font.
14 minutes.
But I was like, let's go with it. Sounds good.
Oh, literally. Anita's looking at me like, okay, really though? Okay. So you know what? Instead of continuing on with the Alex segment, we're going to go into topic number one. Oh my God. Oh, you guys, before we get into topic number one, I really quickly wanted to make sure you know that we have a very exciting series coming out. It's called Bonus the Nation, and it's basically all of the bonus episodes of Fake the Nation on Stitcher Premium. So if you're looking for a way to support the show, and so many of you have reached out and asked me how you can support the show, well, this is the big way you can support the show is to become a member of Stitcher Premium and listen to all of Bonus the Nation, and you can do that by going to stitcherpremium.com and using the code FAKE, that's F-A-K-E. So I hope you do that. The episodes are so good. We have been recording them and I'm like just really proud of them and really excited to share them with you. And you're going to love it. So again, that's, go to Stitcher Premium and use the code FAKE. And now let's get into topic number one. So, let's start with the miserable elections. The argument is continuously made that a contentious primary is, really harmful to the party, that it'll be really bad in the general elections because we'll be so divided. I argue what's actually ruining the party is how fucking long this process is and how many states are essentially disenfranchised by the primary schedule. It's what I've been saying, and I will continue to say it because I would like for us to actually change it. All right, I've been frustrated my whole life. Let's change it, though. But my question to you guys is, how do you feel? Where are the debates on Tuesday? Too contentious for comfort?
It was hard to tell what anyone was saying. It's like all the transcripts are just crosstalk all of the time. I wish they didn't all feel the need to fight each other on everything, especially when you've got like Sanders and Warren, who are both the most progressive candidates that I know of in history. You know, like, why do they need to butt heads all the time? Not needed.
Yeah. I mean, there's an element of desperation here just because of the calendar and the math. And so now, and it happens in every primary where people just realize like, oh no, this is my last shot. It was a horrible debate. In terms of just what you were discussing, so much crosstalk. The moderators were terrible. It was just a bad sort of product, and I don't think we learned much. I feel like it was pretty typical for a debate where a leader is someone in first is consolidating, and there are a couple of lanes that are consolidating, and it's the kind of like, this is our last chance. And compare it to the Republican debates in 2016, which were all like that.
Yeah, true.
Which were all that sort of yelly and crosstalky, but then also like bragging about penis size. This one felt, much more high-minded than those.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, I think, there were some moments. I feel like, everyone, piled on Bernie for a little bit because he is the, seeming front runner. He has won, a plurality in three primary contests that should make no bearing on how you decide to vote in your future primary, whenever that is in New York. It's fucking next year. Our primary really doesn't matter. But anyways, it's in April.
But it's a small state. What are you going to do?
I think there was, look, I feel like everyone's saying the kind of same thing, which is like Pete and Amy sort of like canceled each other out, or they just sort of like fell into like a weird crevice.
I thought Buttigieg had actually a pretty strong debate.
Really?
I mean, I thought, you know, for what he needs to do and how he needs to sort of present himself, he had, you know, calm answers, rational answers. He spoke to a certain kind of, I think, voter that is genuinely out there. I don't think it's going to shift the calculus considerably for him, but I thought he acquitted himself pretty well.
I mean, yeah, look, like they are all, again, if we're comparing this to the Republican debates of 2016, sure, like they all fucking did great. You know what I mean? Like they all like said some things about policy and, fucking the one thing that I thought was maybe like a needless distraction was the Cuba stuff, which we can get into, like what it means to have that in the air.
Yeah.
So there was a big claim about Bernie kind of saying nice things about Cuba. And, you know, when you say it like that, you're like, so what? Or whatever. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So like, can you guys, I mean, explain to me what's the problem here?
I feel like so many issues that come up in these debates are not incredibly relevant. Like almost all issues matter. It's just a thing of like, when he's the president, is he just going to like surrender to the Cubans or something? It doesn't matter.
Like, right.
Who cares?
Right, like, at this stage, the claim is that he's like said some nice things about their healthcare system and their education system.
Yeah, I think he's pro-healthcare and pro-education and just right, is looking for ideas.
It ties into a larger story about Bernie Sanders, which is absolutely going to be the defining issue, I think, if it's him versus Trump,
right,
which is that
election.
He's a self-avowed socialist. And what does that mean? And for a lot of voters, you know, I would say for millennials, when they think socialism, they think, Nordic countries, they think Sweden and Denmark. And for older voters, they think, you know, Cold War, and it's going to fall out along those lines.
Yeah.
And so I thought that was a good preview of some of the stuff he's going to have to face. And frankly, he's going to have to face a much, much
harsher,
and, you know, worse faith arguments than that.
And I think he needs to do a better job of handling it. You know, he has a hard time. I think one of the points that was really interesting to me was Biden bringing up Bernie's record on gun control. And I actually feel like, you know, he didn't really he has to have a better answer for that, too. No. You know, he said like that was a bad vote, talking about the Brady bill.
Yeah.
But I want to hear, I think people want to hear some real, genuine emotion on what bad a vote that was and what it means and how he's changed and what he really wants to do. Like, I don't feel he's as full-throated on gun control and his bad votes in the past, which are going to, you know, which for the Democratic Party are going to come up, probably won't come up in the general election, to be
right.
Frank.
Yeah.
Right? So, but as a primary candidate, to me, that's a big issue. And I would love to hear just like a beautiful, like, change of heart and what that meant to him to change. And I don't know. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I also think, like, this primary stage is really interesting to find out exactly how well they can argue things. And then in the general, it's just going to be whoever the nominee is a crazed socialist.
Yes.
And whoever the nominee is out to round up all the guns. And so, like, even if we don't pick the actual literal socialist, they're just going to get called that by Republicans for, like, a year.
I mean, there is this, like, nervousness, I think, among Democrats that, like, oh, no, if it's Bernie or so, you know, particularly Bernie, but, you know, it's going to be a chaotic election in the fall. The election is going to be chaotic no matter who it is.
And also, right? Democrats aren't nuts, right? Democrats aren't going to be like, oh, I'm just not going to vote. It's been too contentious. Like, that's just not, I don't understand that argument. But, let's talk about, so I just want to say, for the record, we all know I'm in the bag for Elizabeth Warren. I thought she was fucking fantastic and super presidential during the debates. But we don't need to harp on that because you guys all know how I feel. I will, however, I do think, though, let's just quickly make the case for Bernie. Why would he be a good commander in chief? Why would he do well in the general? What is the case for him?
I think when I think about Sanders and Warren, I feel like they both come to a lot of the same policies, but from sort of opposite mm-hmm. life directions.
Yeah.
Like Sanders came from it to it from being like even more of a socialist, maybe.
Right? Like ideological. Yeah.
And then Warren came to it from being a Republican and then seeing Republicans ravage the economy. You know, like it's a very interesting paths for both of them. And I'm trying to see the choice between them as like a nice opportunity, you know? Like it's real lucky to have both of them around. It's like tough that I can only
nice
vote for one of
it.
Them. But I don't know. I think it's a good thing.
Yeah,
they're both great.
Jody, what is the case if someone wanted to go pull the lever for Bernie?
Well, other than, you know, he's running away with the thing. I mean, we'll see how it goes in the fall.
We'll see how it goes in South Carolina. That disenfranchises me, so stop
sure,
that.
But even Elizabeth Warren is saying we have to play by the rules as they exist, as flawed as they are. And, you know, so that is. Mm. But in the general, I mean, I think that Bernie Sanders is the riskiest candidate in a sort of strict definition of risk, which is he has the highest upside and the lowest downside. Mm-hmm. And I think that makes a lot of people nervous. But, you know, I do think we have to look at how big the upside is. And I mean, if you were to make a list of things that Bernie Sanders needed to do over the course of the primary to kind of like check boxes and show that he can get things done, he is kind of going through that list. I mean, he won the first two contests. Then he went to Nevada, where he sort of showed that he can win a diverse coalition. His argument about turnout, there has been pretty big turnout, not bonkers turnout, but pretty big turnout.
Right, but it hasn't been, like, they're arguing that there would be a sort of sea change type turnout,
sure.
And that hasn't been the case in these primaries so far.
Sure, but, you know, when you get to a general election and everything's just him versus Trump, and again, you know, the upside is there. I do think the next things on the kind of checklist are things that are going to be a little harder for Bernie, which is frankly a little what you were discussing earlier, which is like tightening up his talking points and in a way like doing it in a way that will mollify the party elites.
Yeah.
And, you know, you do have to sort of play that game, but Bernie has shown no interest. I mean, that's kind of why people like him in playing that game. So that's the big question, I think, over the next few weeks. But, you know, there is like he has kind of done everything that you would ask of someone in his position up to this point.
Yeah, I feel like if he shows a little heart and discipline and maybe a touch of remorse on some of the bad votes, that he can really pull it out of the bag for Democratic primary voters who are like, you know, questioning him. I think part of the reason people like him is that he's never like he has that little bit of a Trumpian quality where he doesn't say I'm sorry. He has played by the rules. He did begrudgingly support Hillary Clinton in 2016. Right. Like he like has done the things he are sort of supposed to do. If he can do them with a little more gusto and a little more politicking, then he'd be really in a great position, I think, not only for Democratic primary voters who are questioning him.
You're describing Elizabeth Warren. You're describing the Elizabeth Warren in your head.
Yeah. I'm literally trying not to promote Elizabeth Warren
right
now.
But
this is what I'm saying. Like, it's possible. He's a fucking adult. He's got all of the fancy smart people. They know what to do. So do it. You know what I mean? So do that.
Well, I know I was just saying that they also, I think I was kind of saying they're both the same in a lot of ways, but also one thing that is nice for him is he can a little bit run against the Democratic Party, kind of like there were.
Right, the way Trump was running against the Republican Party.
Yeah, like Trump never meant it, but he could run against like Bush's wars a little bit,
mm-hmm,
you know?
Mm-hmm.
And Bernie can say, I'm a great Democratic candidate and I don't do a lot of their mistakes.
Yeah.
And whether or not that's totally true or not, it's a really convincing pitch for people, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, let's quickly also now make the case for Biden, because Biden just got, you know, he's seemingly in the polls ahead of everybody in South Carolina. You know, the population of South Carolina, what is it, like 50% African-American or something? Mm-hmm. It's a very high percentage of African-American voters in South Carolina. So that's going to be like a very big litmus test for that demographic. And then he also just got the endorsement of Clyburn in Congress, which is like a really big deal for South Carolina. What is the case for pulling the lever for Biden?
It's weird. I think like it used to be, you know, so many candidates. And now that we've winnowed it down a bit, I think he fell into being like maybe the third best Democratic option, like by attrition. I thought people like Julian Castro were amazing and that now they're just not in it anymore.
Right, right, right.
But of the people who are not Sanders and Warren, I think I'm the most into him. It's very marginal.
That's
though.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Can I point out something about Biden? I did a little side-by-side comparison yesterday of Biden and Bernie. They you know, like, for example, they both want to end cash bail. They want to both eliminate mandatory minimum sentences and private prisons and raise the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour. You know, there's he indicates support of paid family leave, which is a big progressive platform as well. You know, so there's a lot of things on which he's actually, you know, quite progressive. And then there's some, you know, things where, you know, for example, like he wants to end new oil and gas leases on federal land and end offshore drilling, but maybe supports some limited fracking or understands that fracking might be a transitional energy, the way I think Klobuchar also pointed has that position. He wants to tax carbon emissions versus like imposing severe like regulations on them. So he's maybe a little bit robust on some of these other issues where a progressive candidate would be more robust.
And I think everybody's pushed him left a bit too, and that's okay.
And that's okay.
Yeah.
And I think, yeah. So if you want to pull the lever for Biden, and look, many Americans do. So that's just something we should reckon with, though I believe they should be doing it for Warren. Doesn't matter. but if you want to pull the lever for Biden, you're not pulling the, it's not the Biden of 2008,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It is a slightly more liberal Joe Biden. And I think that's, you know, something that could hearten Democratic primary voters if, in fact, we do end up with Biden as the nominee.
Yeah,
I think that's a great summation of where he stands policy-wise. I'll just point out sort of electorally, I mean, this is the case with these primaries where every 2 days there's an entirely new conventional wisdom and it actually does have an impact and people react to it. But, you know, all along, Biden's strategy was kind of, I'm going to let the first three, certainly the first two go, and I'm just going to wait for South Carolina, and that's going to be my firewall, and then I'm going to go from there. And there is a pretty good chance that that exact strategy could start to play out. And so we just need to remember that, like, before any of this voting started, we had a notion of what Biden's strategy was that is still in place. You know, I think certainly the way he fell off a cliff in the first three states says something,
yeah.
But he is,
yeah.
You know, his chances is for South Carolina. I don't know when people are going to listen to this, but his chances for South Carolina are going up. I think he is in the driver's seat there. And then you never know. Like,
yeah.
If he can consolidate that lane, it may just be that, oh, Biden knew what he was doing all along.
Right. And then a third of the population votes on Super Tuesday.
Yep.
But remember that still more than half of the population awaits their vote.
So can I ask you a question about that? Because you started by saying this thing has been going on forever.
Yeah.
And then you said, but only a small percentage of states get
yes.
to decide. How do you square those things? Because if your instinct is, I want everyone to have a say,
yeah.
What you're talking about is a year-long election.
I'm talking about,
where we hold off on this, and that drags and drags and drags.
Well, I'm talking about a same-day primary
okay. yeah.
With ranked choice voting, or a same-day primary with a runoff
sure.
vote as well.
Right.
So that's what I'm talking
yeah.
about.
Okay.
And the Democratic Party can design ways through where they place debates and through where they do straw polls and blah, blah, blah to make that make it so that, you know, the candidates go to rural areas,
yeah.
blah, 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 blah. There's just ways to design it to make it still friendly to small states. So I know that's an issue. Anyways, we're not talking about that today. Today, we are going to okay, so that was, guys, the point was I wanted to make a case for Bernie, a case for Biden, so that I'm not so Warren heavy.
Yeah.
And
I think Biden is the most reasonable way you can make a mistake as a voter. It's the absolute best, most straightforward, most honorable error.
If it's listed alphabetically, he's at the top.
That should be on a campaign poster. Like, Biden, the most reasonable way to make a mistake.
Yeah, yeah. At least it's not the crazy Bloomberg guy who just bought your vote with
right.
enough TV ads pointed at you.
Yes,
you know? Like,
yes.
Good job. That's fine.
Totally.
Yeah.
And I sort of feel the same. Actually, feel very much that way about, you know, Klobuchar and Pete too. That they're good, right? Like, they're good.
Yeah. they've done public service before
done
public, and stuff.
They're good.
Yeah. You know,
yeah. So So I feel like, look, I don't think we should be so fucking down about the candidates. And I don't think that a Bernie nomination is the end of the world the way everybody's writing about it. But I think it's because it's either you write about that or the coronavirus this week. Mm-hmm. So I feel like, fuck that narrative. You know what I mean? We have a slate of very excellent candidates, plus a billionaire who wants to buy your vote. So, you know, and let's remember that.
And one other little thing that's worth keeping in mind is just that as chaotic as that debate felt, as much as it felt like they were all going after each other, no one is going to remember it in 6 months. I mean, we will just have forgotten it. And there is also empirical evidence that tends to show that contested primaries don't mean that the candidate emerges more harmed in the general. It's just
a huge
reset button when we get into the general, and there will be huge things that we can't even foresee now when it's in the general. And so, you know, I know it makes people nervous. We're like, oh, everyone should get along. Like, oh, we're saying things on this stage that then is going to get used in the fall. They're going to find that the awful things to say in the fall, regardless of what got said on the debate stage in late February. So just, you know, it's fine.
So everyone calm down. All right, you guys, why don't we take a quick break and learn about our sponsors? And then when we come back, we'll talk coronavirus.
Today's show is sponsored by Prose. This is kind of, I feel like, you know, I'm on some sort of Lord of the Rings journey trying to figure out skincare. And I feel like this customized skincare line is really got my name on it. Basically, every bottle of Prose custom hair care and skincare, I tried the skincare just recently, is made to order and it's personalized. It's got a unique blend of naturally powerful and proven effective ingredients to meet your needs, like specifically you. And then the way they do it is you take this great, like in-depth quiz, basically. They analyze over 80 factors for a complete view of your life, your beauty goals. Like I have oily skin that's also dry, which is just a fun little conundrum. I live in New York City. Like we've got these four seasons. My face gets weird during seasonal shifts. All of these things I got to kind of talk about in answering the questions. The other fun thing was they asked us at the end, like, do you like a creamy type of moisturizer or like a less creamy kind? And I was kind of like, I think like less creamy. And they were like, that's fine. Like you can do that, but we think for your skin type, creamier is better. And I never knew that. So I love that there's so much kind of personal information that goes into creating this. I got my stuff in the mail very quickly after. I got a wonderful serum. Like I said, this very creamy moisturizer. And this also very just delectably creamy cleanser that just kind of feel like I think it's possible that I've been washing my face with just like harshness. For like many years, because when I saw this cleanser, I was like, oh, is this what it's supposed to feel like? It's supposed to feel like a little bit of a delight on my face. That's not what I've been doing. So I don't know, guys. And here's the thing. You don't have to take my word for it. In a third-party, double-blind, dermatologist-supervised controlled clinical study, which is like the gold standard for research studies, Prose prove that personalization works better than off-the-shelf alternatives, which just sort of totally makes sense on a just logical level if you think about it. Just it makes common sense. Prose is so confident that you'll love your results that they're offering my listeners an exclusive trial offer so you can see the difference custom care can make. 50% of your first subscription order at prose.com/fakethenation will be taken off. That's prose.com/fakethenation. You get your free consultation and 50% off your one-of-a-kind formulas. Again, that's prose.com/fakethenation. Go and get your just super personalized, luxurious skincare products and hair care products. That's what I'm going to try next. So prose.com/fakethenation.
I am the type of person that has subscribed to things and I have forgotten about those things. I have paid twice for a children's educational app and I didn't know that I was paying twice for several
months. Until that is, I discovered Rocket Money. And because I use Rocket Money, it just showed up all these things. The thing that I was paying twice for that made me incredibly angry. Thank God Rocket Money ended that for me. It also cancels the subscription for you. So you don't have to like go through the hassle of going to that site and figuring out how to cancel. They actually make canceling very difficult. I don't know if any of you have had the experience, but I have been on a like a roundabout 8-exit nightmare trying to unsubscribe to something before. Rocket Money eliminates that hassle. It also alerts you to an increase in subscription price. And this is something Rocket Money did for me. It negotiates a lower price for something you already subscribed to. So like for my cable bill, it got me a lower price. And I was very happy about that. Nearly 75% of people have subscriptions that they've forgotten about, which makes me feel better because I'm one of them. But it makes me feel terrible because what are we doing? Losing that money. I don't want to waste that money. And I know you don't want to waste that money. If you struggle with these kinds of purchases, if you struggle with finances in general, Rocket Money will help you with the budgeting, help you track your expenses, help you, like I said, cancel those unwanted subscriptions. It's a personal finance app that finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions. It monitors your spending. It helps you lower your bills so you can get back to saving. I mean, me and my husband have been on the warpath, and Rocket Money has been a really big part of that. It has over 5 million users with over $500 million in canceled subscriptions. The average member has saved up to $740 a year using the app's features, which is, I mean, that tracks for me. So stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions. Go to rocketmoney.com/fakethenation. Again, that's rocketmoney.com/fakethenation. Save the money at rocketmoney.com/fakethenation. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Also, discover more than 60 add-ons every week, like breakfast, on-the-go lunch, snacks, and beverages to help you stay fueled and feel good all day long. What are you waiting for? Folks, I feel like I've mentioned this before, but I tried other services that I was displeased with. And then a neighbor of mine was trying Factor. I had pulled them aside in the hallway and I was like, what are you feeling about this Factor? And they were like, it is delicious. You should definitely do it. So then me and my husband did it and we loved it. They are chef-prepared meals that arrive to your door, and then in 2 minutes, you could be eating them. Like, it's so simple, and they're actually delicious. And for people like me who just sometimes, my schedule can be so maniacal between traveling in different cities and, you know, doing stand-up gigs. It's like I just don't have a typical schedule where I can plan, set aside time for cooking and all that stuff. So something like Factor really helps for me. The other thing that I love to do is try not to eat carbs. So they have a keto option, which is fantastic. It's super delicious. They use premium ingredients. You can get stuff with like filet mignon and shrimp and truffle butter and broccolini and asparagus, right? Like real ingredients. They're no fuss, no mess meals. They eliminate the hassle of having to prep. They're tailored to your schedule. You can customize your weekly meals with flexibility. You can pause or reschedule. I've actually done that. I've both paused and rescheduled. Factor is basically your solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. We're celebrating Earth Day all month long, and look out for the Earth Month Eats badge on the menu for the lowest carbon footprint meals. So here's what I think you should do. I think you should head to factormeals.com/fakethenation50 and use the code fakethenation50 to get 50% off your first month plus 20% off your next month. That's code fakethenation50 at factormeals.com/fakethenation50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This HeadGum Podcast is brought to you by Aura Frames.
That is right.
From grandmothers to new mothers, aunts, even the friends of your life, every mom loves an Aura Frame.
Holy shit, even aunts?
Yes, especially aunts.
Oh, well.
Because it was named the best digital photo frame by Wirecutter and selected as one of Oprah's favorite things. I mean, these Aura Frames are guaranteed to bring joy to moms of all ages.
I believe it.
You have an Aura Frame, don't you?
Yes, I actually more than believe it. I know it. I've got one for my mom, my mother-in-law, my grandmother-in-law.
And dare I say, your aunt?
And dare you say, my aunt and my aunt-in-law. Everyone's got one. Everyone loves them.
I mean, Mother's Day is right around the corner, and there's no better gift than a digital photo frame. You give them the frame. It's got preloaded pictures in there. And you know what? You can update it with an app. So every time you take a new picture of a sweet little person or place or thing in your life, it gets automatically sent to that frame.
Exactly.
And right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. Holy smokes.
Excellent deal.
Yeah, that's AuraFrames.com. You use the code HEADGUM at checkout to save.
HEADGUM. Nice.
Yes. HeadGum. It's easy to set up. It's loved by everybody, including Oprah, including your aunt.
Mm-hmm.
So do check them out. That's AuraFrames.com. Use code HeadGum at checkout to save.
Damn right.
And terms and conditions apply, of course.
Of course.
Thanks again to Aura.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's Byte.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
And we are back, and we're ready for topic number 1.5. Okay. The CDC's principal deputy director said this week that, quote, it's not a question of if, it's a question of when and how many people will be infected, referring to the coronavirus. You know, this is what makes mothers around the country call their daughters in utter panic.
I did when you said your mom has called you twice a day. I was like, oh, is she busy or something? Like, she hasn't got much time. Or like, it's constant. Yeah, everybody's freaking out.
I haven't gotten a single call from my mom.
Well, no, I mean, she called twice, once because I couldn't really talk, and then another she called the day before. So, anyways, she's called like basically 2 days in a row. I don't mean exaggerate my claims. She's not a crazy person, but she is like a worry wart. So I guess
it's their role. It's good.
And you know what it is? It's like, I mean, and I think for me too, it's the images out of Italy. Mm-hmm. For some reason, I mean, it's like, for some reason, you sort of were like, well, a Western country will have exactly the right response to this situation, and they will shut it down immediately, and there won't be a problem, and everyone will be on the streets of Milan. And then to see the streets of Milan empty in the news footage, I think that is quite shocking. So do you feel like there's basically, is it, are we at mom panic, or should we be where Trump is, where he's like, everything's fine, don't worry?
My mother or Trump? Who do I trust in most situations?
It's the worst general election decision.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing where, as an individual, I don't know what to do about a global pandemic, really. Like, I'll save up some food and try to wash my hands a lot and stuff.
Yeah.
But I'm just trying to be wary. I'm flying from JFK to LAX tomorrow, so I'm not a wise person, but I am. I'm hopeful it'll work out, and we see what happens. I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems to me like this was the week in which a lot of people realized this is going to be a thing that we live with.
Right.
And actually, I see some hope there, because I think a lot of the pieces that came out this week, I'll give a shout out to my friend Jim Hamblin, who wrote a piece for The Atlantic that I thought was the smartest on this front, which is basically saying a lot of the world is going to get this thing.
Yeah.
But the reason that it spread so fast and we weren't able to contain it is because a lot of the cases are mild or asymptomatic. And that means that it is a very serious virus, but it is not Ebola. It is not these things where you get it and all of a sudden everyone realizes you have it and you get quarantined and so forth. So, you know, I think I've chatted with him. I think, you know,
subtlety is what's so dangerous
about
it.
And I think it's just going to be in a couple years. Like right now, what, when we enter a winter, we have the flu and pneumonia. And, you know, now we're going to have the flu, pneumonia, and coronavirus. It's going to be one of those just things that is out there that we're going to have to deal with. To me, I think the real danger, and this is where Trump is, you know, I think scares me, is in the political response. And that's where I think it's going to be, both in terms of containment of it, but also, you know, I my hunch is what Trump is going to do is go from one extreme of everything's going to be fine all the way to another extreme of, I don't know. I mean, I, you know, but it does scare me, the risk of shutting things down and taking sort of really sort of strong man, you know, I think there's going to be a
version of like a war would be shut everything down.
Whatever
the
sending troops to the border equivalent of dealing with this is. And I mean, that is to me, I think, you know, a real fear is the sort of political response and a real worry because, you know, in his head, I think containment is the only bar. And this is going to grow regardless of what politicians do. And it's really about mitigating that growth and being smart and thinking about this as a thing that's going to be with us for over years and decades. And he's not built that way.
And what did you guys think of him naming Pence as the head of the project?
Oh, Dr. Mike Pence? Well, it's very good. I'm trying to be an optimist about things. And when I saw that press conference, which was not a good press conference and not any good ideas, I also thought, like, at least Trump supporters will have heard of the disease. Like, good. Like, if we're so divided in our media diets, at least him talking about it is like an awareness campaign for a lot of people.
Yeah, that's a good point.
But that's the only good thing. Mike Pence is there to be a scapegoat or do nothing. That's it.
Right. That's what I sort of felt. It felt like, I'm going to put this guy that's an afterthought in my entire administration at the head of the thing. And I think, you know, obviously eyebrows were raised because under Pence's watch in Indiana, there was an AIDS outbreak and they wanted him to provide clean needles for intervenous drug users. And he wouldn't do it because he thought it would promote more drug use. And instead, it actually just created this AIDS outbreak.
Well, how could he have known that other than data and science? And
right. No, and that everyone told him. Yeah. Like, so.
Yeah. Oh, boy.
So that's, I mean, I think a big concern is that he hasn't shown any real good judgment on this type, on viruses in the past, how they move.
I don't know if I'm like too easily upset, but every time Trump or the media reports this as a stock market story, really bugs me. Really don't like it. It's a disease. It's people's lives.
Yeah, but in terms of things that will affect Trump.
And get his attention, and also
frankly, be threats to his reelection. Like, I genuinely think this could be a threat to his reelection,
right?
Because of both the stock market, which I think he equates with the economy. That's a whole other thing, but he uses it as a way to say the economy is doing well, which I think is his strongest argument. So if that goes off the table because of this, it has direct electoral implications, and because of his behavior and his reaction. And I mean, if he takes draconian measures, it will be something that I think it genuinely has the ability to affect the
election. Yeah, no, I agree. And it's so odd because right now we're in that phase of his psyche where he's so arrogant. He thinks that under his presidency, coronavirus won't affect people. You know what I mean? It's so fucking bananas. But that's like the message, right?
Right.
And so I know. But I wanted to mention a couple of things for those of you who might be panicking out there. Does anyone remember, like, how SARS, like, went? Do you remember feeling what SARS happened? It was I don't remember very much, but it was essentially like a wash your hands campaign that kind of put an end to SARS. SARS was, I think, was less lethal. I think, and, yeah. I think, less easily transmitted.
And was a little more contained. But I agree. It's important to remember these previous moments of panic. Don't talk about 1916, but, you know, other than that.
Spanish flu. So the wash your hands thing, still very important, guys. Wash your hands. And then another one, which is, I think, a harder habit to break, is coughing into your elbow, not your hand.
Yeah.
Because we learned as kids to cough into your hand. That's a bad idea. You cough into your elbow, guys. So do that. And then, keep some look, they're saying that you should be prepared, and just hopefully you won't have to use any of these precautions, but have a month's supply of food, and have, if you're on some sort of medication, have a month's supply of that. Also, weirdly, the weirdest thing is that so many of our drugs get made in China. So they're a supplier for so many, especially antibiotics. I think the other positive thing that could come out of this is recognizing that one country shouldn't have some sort of monopolistic dominance over the manufacture of some very important things in our life. You know what I mean? Let's fucking diversify, guys. Anyways. So there's and then a safe distance to from people who are coughing and stuff like that is 6 feet. Avoid Japan, Italy, Iran, and China and South Korea right now for traveling purposes. and I think, and if you're sick, stay home from work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, many elements of it are just good things to do. I've only been in New York a couple of days, and everyone's been offering me hand sanitizer all the time. And I'm like, oh, what a utopian society where I'm just given hand sanitizer.
It's
all
the same advice that we get every flu season, but for real.
Do them this time. Right. Exactly. Basically wash your hands all the time and then wash surfaces. Oh, that's a big way that things get transmitted is surfaces. You put your hand on a surface, and previously someone had coughed on that surface. So, your counters, your desks, do some nice wipings, All right, you guys, we are going to move on to topic number two. Okay, so last week, Jeff Bezos announced that he was giving $10 billion of his own money to climate change. He's worth $130 billion, by the way, so I just want to point out, so we can just see what percentage that is. Amazon, by the way, is also one of the biggest polluters in the world. Okay, whatever. Also, side note. And companies like Microsoft and Delta have also announced climate change as part of their mission. And it seems to be a growing trend. Is this a trend we should believe in, amidst intergovernmental inaction? Is this, are corporations the answer?
No, they're not. Well, I feel like a corporation's job is truly to make money. That's what they exist to do. A government's job is to manage that and take care of us. And so it's the government's job. If a corporation wants to do anything, that's great. It's also probably free advertising and marketing for themselves as a positive force. So anything they want to do is good. But I don't know. I'm always hung up on Jeff Bezos's company being named after one of the most famous rainforests. And yet they're they're a huge, detriment to that. It's very weird and probably an accident.
I agree. I think with most things, when someone does something, it's very good to take a half a step back and sort of look at what their motivations are and think about where they're, why they're really doing this. That said, at this point, I will take crass capitalistic incentives if it means, actual action. But I think the interesting conversation that this has spurred is around the kind of larger context of, yes, these corporations are making certain efforts, but then you look at the political lobbying they do and, the playing the game of, this is only X percentage of his wealth. I don't know about that one. That one always just yes, these people are super duper duper wealthy. Look at the actual amount they're giving and see if that will make a change. But I do think a lot of these corporations that are giving money on one hand or making statements on one hand and then like donating to dysfunctional Congress on the other, you know, donating to Mitch McConnell, who has held up a bunch of these legislations, and it's ultimately going to be political action that solves these things. That is something that we should absolutely interrogate.
Yeah, and I want to point out that the case that you're talking about is, you know, Microsoft pledges, you know, to go carbon negative by 2030, which means they basically want to be removing carbon from the atmosphere. And some of the things they want to do is invest in carbon capture. And that's fantastic. The only problem is carbon capture doesn't really exist yet, like in an actual feasible form that could have like effect on a global scale. So some of these promises are a little bit like meh. But then the weird thing about Microsoft, as Jody was mentioning, is that they've also, you know, heavily donated to the election of Mitch McConnell, you know, who basically questions climate change science and has like a 7% lifetime score from the League of Conservation Voters. So he's garbage when it comes to conservation and climate change.
Well, everyone has one fault, you know?
There's that optimism.
It's just one fault. But like a lot of these things, it does come down to political will and political action and you know, long-term thinking on the part of our elected officials. And that is not – we're not living in a sort of golden age for that.
No, again, like I think it's interesting to look at these different countries and what they're doing and how meaningful it is. And not just – I think let us not be overly impressed by claims. I think that's something that we should look out for. Because part of what upsets me is that a major precipitating factor for all of these climate change becoming a part of their corporate missions of a lot of these huge companies is that this guy Larry Fink of BlackRock, who invests – who they have majority stakeholding in so many of these companies. He basically came out with a letter. He apparently writes some fucking famous letter every year or whatever. And he came out with this letter that's like climate change has to be a part of like what we do and what corporations do. And, you know, it can't just be profit. And that's great. And so then BlackRock, you know, one of the things they said was as I look for the thing that they said, that they would no longer invest in companies deriving 25% or more of their revenues from thermal coal. And that's great. But then it actually only affects about a quarter of the emissions from coal, right? Like it's not – they weren't like we're completely divesting from thermal coal, right? Yeah. So again, like, that's great, Larry Fink. That's fantastic that you said that with your famous little letter. And then that's great, you know, that's great that you're that BlackRock won't invest in companies deriving 25% or more of their revenues from thermal coal. But it's like, you could have gone further. Same, you know, same with Jeff Bezos, right? Like $10 billion, like that's totally great, like super fantastic for you and for the globe, hopefully. However, you have more money than that. And also, your company is a big polluter. Yeah. So what is your company going to do? And, you know, and some of those things are true and good, like replacing the trucks with electric fleet. You know, you kind of have to carry through, where does the electricity come from for that fleet? Okay. Is it coming from solar panels? That's great. If it's coming from wind, that's great. If it's not, if it's coming from coal, that is not great. You know what I mean? So we need to like, we need more transparency basically. Well, what exactly does all of this mean when it's coming from someone like Jeff Bezos and Amazon? Well, Delta, for example, said that they're a huge, they're an airline. They're a fucking airline, right? So they're going to be a huge carbon emitter. But they said by March 1st, they're going to go carbon neutral. So basically what that means for Delta, it doesn't mean that planes are solar powered, obviously. It means that they're going to buy carbon offsets. And that's great. But also, we don't know exactly how much carbon offsets actually offset. You know, it could be you're funding an entirely new forest. It could mean you're funding someone not to cut down a forest. It's unclear.
Anytime I try to read a story about carbon offsets, I feel like I'm reading about like trades in a sport. I don't know. Like, it's really, it's very hard to follow. It's like they're trading their stuff for a coral reef to be named later. And like, I don't know what's going on.
Yeah.
Can I ask you a question though? Cause earlier you mentioned, and I think about this too, and I'm curious where you're at, like, that a lot of this feels like marketing, you know, and that we're at a point now where it feels like it's cynical, but it's, you know, a good look to talk about these things. Do you think we're still at that place where you see a lot of these big corporations, or do you think it started to shift over? You know, if you have like doing nothing, a spectrum of like doing nothing, doing something because it's good marketing, doing something because it's good economic interest, and then doing something because it's the right thing to do. I don't think we're at the right thing to do level yet, but have we shifted from people are acting because it's good marketing to people are acting because there's actually an economic incentive to act?
That's a great question. I think, it's easy to say it's a mix, but like I actually, with the presidential stuff, I've been thinking about Tom Steyer a lot, because Tom Steyer is like, other than pointlessly running for president and wasting our time, pretty cool. Like he's done. He's
that's a bumper sticker.
He made a bunch of money and then spent it on like
on good things.
Like in 2010, he put $5 million into defeating a ballot measure that would have held back a bunch of California environmental legislation. And like there are people out there like that who, all the way from small business owners who are saying like, I want to be one of the small businesses that is good, to people who work their way up to being like the CEO of Delta or something and say like, oh, I really want to do something good. Mm-hmm. There are those people out there. And then also it's a good way to market to half the country. And it's just so hard to pull apart.
It does seem that he's spending most of his post-business life apologizing for having made so much money in his business life and trying to make good on it. I mean, it does feel that way with Tom Steyer, actually.
Yeah. And if he bankrolled like hundreds of progressive candidates instead of buying all of Iowa's airtime, he would be the best.
Right.
I would love it.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is also, I will say, one of the arguments for Bloomberg. Sorry to say this, but you know that like that, you know, he could spend his money, and he, you know, again, we will see. But he has pledged to continue to spend at this rate, regardless of who the nominee is. I'm curious to
see
how that plays out.
If it's Bernie,
and I don't think it's just a crisis of conscience, though. It's a mix of all these things.
Yeah, I hope Mike doesn't hear the things I've been saying about him. Oh boy, he might change his mind.
I do want to say, in terms of your spectrum of like doing nothing, doing something because of good PR, blah blah blah. Like Delta's putting in $100 million a year on this offset. If we see actual transparency and actual reporting of where did the $100 million go, what did that offset, what was, you know, like I want real investigative reporting on that, then $100 million is a shitload of money. You know what I mean? It's not, it does dig into their profits, right? Like that's a number that is something that's putting a dent in profit, and I think that at least is admirable.
I will say also, like, It's worth noting that the conversation has shifted to these bigger systemic things. Now, it may be bigger systemic moves on the part of businesses. There's obviously moves on the part of, but you know, we are not having an environmental climate crisis conversation based on like, you should recycle your cup or you should change your light bulbs. All of those personal behavior things are important, but I think we've at least sort of flipped and realized that it's going to take big systemic structural changes. And this is an indicator of that.
Yeah. That was just a way of me mentioning Elizabeth.
I know.
You guys, and I want to point out like that the conversation has shifted, and I think one more thing that I would love to add to the shift is like us being really aware of the transparency piece, like what it is that we're doing, that our governments might be doing, that these corporations might be doing. Because, for example, you know, at Amazon, some employees complained that Amazon was still working with oil and gas, and they had written like, you know, letters about it. And then they were told that, you know, they received letters saying like, hey, if you keep complaining about this, like you might be fired. Huh. So that's the kind of...
Oh, like
thing.
In a bad way? No.
But that's the kind of thing.
Freed to go explore your environmental journey. I think that's the way they put it. Yes.
But that's the kind of thing that I'm just like, well, that's what we don't want. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If you believe in doing this, that also means that your employees should be free to be transparent about what the company does and does not do when it comes to their environmental policy.
Totally.
So I don't know. Let me guys, let me know what you think of corporations getting into the climate change game. Do you believe it? Where is your heart on this issue? I'm so excited to hear from you. Let us move on to topic number three. So we read a piece by Maria Browning called In Search of Darkness, in which she described all of these joyful moments of darkness from her childhood. And then she points out, I'm just going to read from her piece, we've mostly lost the darkness now. Even deep in the country, half the houses are adorned with glaring 24-hour lights that push into the surrounding woods and invade the sky. In more urban places, there's scarcely a dark corner left. The whole world is lit up like an interstate truck stop, nominally to make us safer. I thought this was a really interesting piece. My first question is, like, what is your relationship to darkness, and have you noticed a change in over your lifetime?
I really related to the piece, especially because a lot of her darkness experiences also had to do with nature. Mm-hmm. Like, it wasn't her just sitting in a room in her house with the lights off. It was like going out, and I had a lot of formative camping experiences, and also my mom used to volunteer at an observatory. So we would go like look at the stars with like groups and stuff. And that's very distinctive in my mind. Yeah. And always
that's really
I was never doing that and also wound up about school or something, you know, it's very peaceful. Yeah.
Right. And so have you felt like darkness has changed?
Spend a lot of time in LA. It's not really there.
But you can find it pretty quick, right? I mean, I feel like one of the things about LA, maybe it's just the sort of the mountains or whatever, but you can actually, in 20 minutes, get to a place where you're like, oh, wow, stars, you know?
That's a good point. Yeah, you can drive to it fast, and here you probably have to take the Metro North or whatever it is people do. It has to be sought out, and you have to put some resources into it, but then it's great.
Jody, what's your relationship?
I mean, mostly similar to Alex's. I mean, I think like I've spent
same
a lot of
observatory?
Time. Yeah, same observatory? Yeah, same. The same mom who did the same.
I love like halves of an amulet that match. Yeah. And oh, we're brothers. You know, anyway.
I think especially if you live in a city, but I think just in general, like going into the middle of nowhere and looking up and seeing stars is one of those things that will like never get old. Like, mm-hmm. It's like how spring, every year spring happens. I'm like, holy shit, spring. Like, it's warm. Oh, this is crazy. Like, it's never, the thrill never dies away. And that's one thrill that is just always there for me. And I do try and seek it out. I mean, I do also think, though, I think when I was at WMIC for many years, and we did a whole series about like light pollution in the city. And I do think there has been a conversation over the last 10 years a little bit about that and about light being a form of pollution. And I think it's gotten a little better. Maybe I'm just more attuned to it. But I feel like people are realizing that like the blue light off of their phones is not very good. I think people are realizing like when you sleep, you want to be genuinely, you know,
dark.
I've started wearing a sleep mask when I sleep because I think it's like you want to be, and it really helps.
You want to be
really dark. $7. I think we like a lot of things, we're starting to realize the sort of benefit in the simplest things.
Right. I mean, my relationship with darkness is interesting because I grew up in the desert. And then in Palm Springs, California, has an interesting, you know, they have a light pollution policy because, you know, when you're in the desert, you do want to look up and see the stars and you can see them like quite perfectly, you know. And so at night, it was always like very dark, and they don't do a lot of street lights. Like there isn't that much of that stuff. I mean, we do have some of it, but it's definitely noticeably darker when I'm there than any other, you know, if I'm in a suburb of some other city, I would not feel the kind of darkness that I do in Palm Springs. I do think one of the things that has changed is the kind of, I think in suburban context, the like house that puts on the light in the thing, the doorway area for security. I feel like that has become more. And now that everybody has like those cameras, that can easily be hacked into or whatever, and that are like dangerous unto themselves. Those cameras on the porch or whatever, I think those get – I'm talking about things – I know I sound crazy talking about them because I live in an apartment. So I'm like, what is a porch? You know what I mean? But I feel like that whole system of like – you know, security has really led to a lot more of those kinds of lights. And that I feel like is something that I've noticed, even going back to Palm Springs, where we didn't really have very much of that stuff growing up. I feel like I see it now. But, you know, I remember as a kid, there was this, you know, in high school, there's this place in Palm Springs called The Circles, which was essentially just cul-de-sacs that had not been built on. And so they were literally circles, cul-de-sac circles.
Like a pavement pattern, like a crop circle.
Yeah, exactly.
Of
they were just, it
something.
Was just some pavement that was in the shape of a circle. There was, a, I don't know, a handful
of them.
And they
never built the houses.
And they never built the houses. Yeah. I don't know if they ever did. But anyways, they never built the houses. At the time, they hadn't built the houses. So kids would go over there and like, fucking maybe have a cigarette or whatever, right? And I was actually not cool enough to go to the circles. But I did go a few times. Shout out to PSHS and the people who made me feel unwelcome at the circles. I knew my fucking status, guys. I didn't need to be. I didn't need to feel it that hard. Okay.
I'm just imagining this weird pavement and then one little velvet rope, and it's like, no, I can't go. How would I get around?
Well, because you have to drive down the long path to get to the circle, knowing that they're not going to let you in, and then when they say no, you can't use the cul-de-sac to turn around.
Right,
you have to back up.
Right.
It's very awkward.
It's very awkward. Yeah. No, and then the other weird thing about it actually got even darker than just the fucking velvet rope on the circle, because there's something called the tunnels. We had like a lot of just physical structures that we like to call by their names.
The name creativity in this town
is very impressive. But I think the tunnels were very close to the circle, so you could walk to the tunnels, and it was just like a little tunnel underneath the desert that came. You know, it was not very long. It was, I don't, let's say 40 feet long or whatever, and you would walk through them, and it was like very scary because it was really fucking dark, and you would go to the other side, and like that was the whole point of the tunnel. But the weird thing about the desert is that the moon very intensely illuminates everything. So I remember as a child being like, God, this moon really has got its shit together. Like, it's very effective. And it's definitely something, you know, you sort of living in New York City never, I mean, the moon is very much an afterthought of your time, because it's not illuminating like the city.
No, it's not doing its job, but every once in a while you look up and you catch it, and it's kind of great.
Right, especially like the silhouette of the moon against an interesting building, and you're like, oh, Manhattan. Yes. You know what I mean? You have that moment.
Can I point out something in this piece, which I really loved as well?
Yeah.
But, you know, she describes really moments where she loves being in the dark, and she talks about sort of wandering in the woods as the sun falls, or being in her mother's house by herself and it's dark there. And but I think a lot of the situations she's describing, it's not just darkness, but it's also solitude and quiet and these other things that are just as important. And, you know, maybe it's not just you need to be in darkness. It's just we need to cherish moments where we're kind of with ourselves and we're not fielding a million kinds of inputs, and I think darkness is a good proxy for that, because chances are if you're standing in the dark, you might be alone and quiet. But you know, those are the moments that actually I think lead to the kind of beautiful things she's writing about here.
You know,
I'm
gonna go ahead.
You disagree?
I disagree. No, I mean,
you're standing in a dark room, just fucking looking at Twitter, listening to a podcast.
No, because it's funny. You're right. A lot of her stuff. She was clearly like a solitude person, and she also talked about her mom living in the woods. Her mom had left suburbia, or like not even. She was in a small town, and a couple of people had started to move into the area, and she couldn't handle the lights, and she moved into the woods where there was really, really nothing. And that's where she felt the most calm. And I was just like, oh, this is some fucking on Walden Pond shit right here. You know what I mean? But like that whole notion, it's funny because my meaningful memories of darkness was surrounded by other people in darkness. And that's
yeah.
I've never been one of these solitude guys. You know what I mean? Like, I'll fucking do a meditation. I get that I have to because I got the anxiety. But I don't. I am not interested in a world where I don't mm-hmm. see people. You know what I mean? And so for me, darkness is not. For her, it's definitely a solitude thing. And yeah. I think for me, it's more about just appreciating the kind of magnificence of what the moon does and how it does its job, and that you can do that.
I'll very quickly say that there is common ground between us. My ideal situation is being surrounded by a number of people, but no one is saying anything.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
my comfort zone.
Yeah, that's a nice
honestly,
one.
Honestly, I kind of wish that I was hoping this podcast
would just be us.
It should just be us and we mic a campfire, you know? Oh, I'd be the chillest of the world. Love it.
Oh, we fucking skyrocket to number one on the charts. Can I also point out the interesting thing? Because you sort of think of like cities as being, you know, bastions of light or whatever. And my experience of Havana, Cuba, is that it is also very dark. Anyone in here been to Havana?
I have been to Havana.
Did you feel that way in Havana?
There's a part of the old city that is sort of closed in, and so you end up in these alleys or these small roads right. that feel like closed in.
So this is something that really struck me when I was there, and I don't know if it was like in my head or if it was actually happening, but a lot of the like electricity usage is very
sure.
low in the country just because it's a poor country and they don't, you know, a lot of like fluorescent lights and da da da. And so the street lamps are pitched very low. So they're like not illuminating very much.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
It's very odd. And I remember, and the thing is, you know, a lot of the streets are sort of crumbling and the sidewalks are not, you know, clear sidewalks that you can just, you know, confidently make your stride. And so when it was dark, and I remember constantly being like, like just like tripping because it wasn't very illuminated. And we were really struck by that in various parts of Havana to feel that way. And I also think, I have no idea, but I also wonder if that's, you know, maybe they also nationally treasure darkness, you know? I'm making a crazy claim, but there it is.
Well, and America, it's a pretty new country. Like, a lot of our stuff was built after electricity. So it's kind of hard to find places like that. And maybe right. we value it more because we lack it, all over the place.
I think Bernie praised Cuba's relationship with darkness at the debate the other night.
Oh,
yeah. I think you caught that.
He just started unplugging stuff in the room, you know?
we've had this fairly long discussion about darkness, and none of us have said whether we're afraid of the dark.
Well, that's the question about security, right? Like, do you actually feel safer with that porch light, that glaring porch light than
I guess I mean at a sort of deeper level. Like, there's one, it's like, I'm in a built environment and there's a dark pocket and something bad could happen
right,
there
like
versus like I'm in the middle of the
bed.
Woods and is it just the fact that there's no light, does that scare me?
Yes.
Yes.
It is. I always treat myself like I have a superpower when that night vision comes back. I'm like, ooh, now I can see a little bit.
I try to
appreciate
really
that.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. So you're not scared of the dark?
As a kid, like, extremely. I'm doing pretty good. Yeah.
But my question is, so cousin to that question is, do you feel like lightness helps with security? Because that's, I think, a claim we've sort of all bought into, and and it might be dubious.
Yeah, I think people who are strapping a bunch of lights to their house for security specifically are maybe just thinking about scary things rather than making themselves safer. Yeah. Also, anytime I approach somebody's house, like sometimes in LA, and they have those motion lights that just come on, I always feel like I'm doing a crime as soon as the light comes on. Even if I know the person and we're doing a thing.
You're
like,
so I drop the bag of gold and I run away.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you guys, what is your relationship to darkness? And read this piece. I thought it was lovely.
Yeah, very thoughtful. Very good.
You guys. That's the end of the show. How do you feel?
I feel, is this the last one that comes out before Super Tuesday?
Yes. This is the last one to come out before Super Tuesday.
Hey, do the right thing, folks. Warren, Sanders, one of those.
Mostly Warren.
I'm not going to tell you what the right thing is, but I'm also just going to list a couple names of candidates.
I'm just going to slide a note across the table to you at home. It's got a few names on it.
Jody, do you have any final words of encouragement before a third of the country votes on Tuesday?
Everyone calm down. Take a deep breath. Just not near someone who's coughing.
Yeah.
We'll be fine.
Yeah, sit in some darkness and chill out and then vote.
And then vote. And then
maybe
vote.
It's like literally just go sit in a dark room. It's probably the answer to all of these issues we've been discussing.
Go sit in a dark room and think about Elizabeth Warren. Okay. You guys, I would love for the people of Fake the Nation to be able to follow you and all the stuff that you do. Jody Avrigan, where do they do that?
I'm on Twitter at Jody with a Y Avrigan. I also have a newsletter, so people can sign up for that on my website, jodyavrigan.com.
Awesome. I didn't know you had a newsletter, Jody. Yeah. I should sign up to it. Holy shit. Alex, where do people find you? Alex Schmidt, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, at Alex Schmidt on Twitter and alexschmidt.com. And you already listened to this show, so you're doing a great job. And please listen to the Cracked Podcast as well.
Let me try right here.
Oh, thank you.
All right, and you guys know where to find me and all the things that I do. Oh, you guys, please. We have a new series coming out. It's called Bonus the Nation. It's bonus episodes of Fake the Nation, and they are coming to Stitcher Premium on March 6th. I'm so excited about it, and the episodes are so good. We've already recorded a handful of them, and oh my God. And for a free month trial of Stitcher Premium, use the code FAKE. That's F-A-K-E. You'll get all these great episodes. And also all of the other premium stuff that Stitcher has to offer, but mostly Bonus the Nation, which is our bonus episodes of Fake the Nation that you will love if you already love this show. And it's a great way to support this show, so don't forget that. I also wanted to point out that, according to the U.S. Census, South Carolina has a 27.1% black population. I was so wrong about the number I said out loud. So I just wanted to correct that. But what I really want to do is thank the people that make Fake the Nation possible. That's Anita Flores, our producer. Andy Christens, our audio engineer. Gabi Alter wrote our theme music. Lily Fleshler helps with research. And you guys, we'd love to hear from you. Send us your feedback. Topics you think we should be chatting about. Guest ideas. You can leave us a voicemail at 347-770-4981. Or you can drop us a line at comments@fakethenation.com. If you like what you hear, please leave us a review at Apple Podcasts. It helps more people find out about the show. Thank you, guys. We'll see you next week.